This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. In recent weeks, street violence by and against police has shaken the country. Shootings in Baton Rouge, St. Paul, and Dallas have ignited yet another split between police and communities of color. In response, protests from groups like Black Lives Matter continue. Meanwhile, celebrities are using their status to make their voices heard. Here's NBA star Carmelo Anthony opening last week's ESPY Awards.
The events of the past week have put a spotlight on the injustice, distrust, and anger that plagues so many of us. The system is broken. The problems are not new. The violence is not new. And the racial divide definitely is not new. But the urgency to create change is at an all-time high.
So whether it's televised speeches or viral video, how does celebrity platform influence the message? It's one of the things we're going to talk about in this month's installment of Back Channel, Connecting Culture and Context. Joining me, as always, are Mark Anthony Neal and Natalie Bullock Brown. Mark is a professor of African and African American Studies at Duke University. He's an author and host of the webcast Left of Black. Welcome back, Mark. Good to have you here. And Natalie is a professor of film and broadcast media at St. Augustine's University in Raleigh. Hello, Natalie.
Hello, Frank.
So let's start out with Carmelo Anthony joining three other NBA stars, Chris Paul, Dwayne Wade, and LeBron James. It's the opening for the ESPYs. This is a big sports award. So what does it mean for some of the biggest names in basketball to deliver this message at the beginning of that sports award?
I think it's incredibly important. It's important to note that the four of them are actually close friends. So this might be, in fact, things that they've been thinking about for a while. But also imagine for their generation of athletes, the recent death of Muhammad Ali, you know, shift the focus on the responsibility of athletes, you know, under these kinds of circumstances. So I imagine they felt pressured on some sort of level, right, to be visible, to speak, to be accountable, you know, in this particular moment. You know, I'm also of the mindset that some of the backlash that we've been seeing around everything that's been going on these last few weeks, it's not unrelated to, you know, the new CBA in the NBA. Where we suddenly have a generation of young black men who are making extraordinary amount of money, right? More money than they've ever previously made. And that was the news cycle for 4 days. You know, this, you know, backup point guard who's going to be making $36 million over 3 years. I mean, it becomes this kind of narrative of the rich black guy. And so I imagine when things like this happen, you know, the riches of those black ball players feel a need to speak back to the community. But it also speaks to some of the tensions that are going on largely in the larger society also.
Mm-hmm. Natalie?
And I think that, you know, one of the things that has come from exposure to all of these killings in a way that we didn't see before, maybe a couple of years ago with Trayvon Martin's murder, is the people who are black people are realizing, I think, in ways that they didn't before, that it really doesn't matter what your stature. So the rich black guy, the corporate black guy, the police chief black guy, the surgeon black guy, it doesn't matter what your stature in life, you are still potentially a target. And so I think that it's both appropriate and as Mark said, you know, there's a pressure, but I'm sure there's, you know, the athletes and everyone that has been speaking out that's of a, I guess, celebrity status, they understand that, you know, our riches, our stature does not protect us.
And it's not really even brand new for some of these athletes. I mean, LeBron James has been pretty consistent with the Trayvon Martin death. The team posed a hoodies photo, including the white guy, Chris Anderson, who was on the team at the time. Also in terms of response to Eric Garner, you know, the I Can't Breathe t-shirts. Even the commercial he did for Samsung back in December in which, you know, he talked about winning one for the land as in Cleveland, but the backing music is Public Enemy's Welcome to the Terror Dome. So even sonically, right, he's connected into this. And the role that Chris Paul played, you know, when the former L.A. Clippers owner, you know, spoke racist sentiment. Right. I mean, Chris Paul was on the leading edge of what would have been a walkout, you know, of players of the Los Angeles Clippers. So these guys have been pretty consistent, but they've never been so on a platform like the ESPYs.
Not only the platform, but again, I think the fact that it's not the it's a small world after all kind of message. I mean, you said with some of these other things, but in that, I mean, here's Chris Paul, for instance.
We stand before you as fathers, sons, husbands, brothers, uncles, and in my case, as an African-American man
and the nephew of a police officer who was one of the hundreds of thousands of great officers serving this country. But Trayvon Martin, Michael Brown, Tamir Rice, Eric Gardner, Laquan McDonald, Alton Sterling, Philando Castile. This is also our reality.
Okay, L.A. Clippers player Chris Paul at last week's ESPY Awards, and we're talking with Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. That but, dramatic but was punctuating every one of the statements that each of these players used. And it was almost, Mark, it sounded to me like antidote to the narrative that we'd been hearing, you know, but most of the cops are good cops, but most of our system is good, but there's been so much progress. Yeah. And this was antidote. It was like, yes, I'm a brother, I'm a father like you. In fact, I have an uncle who's a police officer, but our reality hasn't changed.
Right. And I think that's one of the things, particularly with the Alton Sterling killing, so many people responded to his son's response to his father's death. And I think for those men that we saw at the ESPYs, I mean, that clearly resonated in a kind of way. They're all fathers. They're all and I imagine even their minds have changed over the last decade or so because they are fathers, because they are parents. Right. They're thinking very differently about this. But the punctuation is important because I think very often in these conversations about, you know, anti-black state violence and also, you know, police shootings. Both the police doing the shooting and obviously in the case recently of police being killed, there's a tendency to talk about feeling and emotionality within the context of that. And so when you have someone like Chris Paul name the names, right, you know, these aren't feelings, right? These are real people. This is data, if you will. You know, these are the facts of the killings, right? And there's no way to get around that particular reality.
And we can't forget to say the names of black women who have been killed in similar manner. It was touching. I had not heard the Chris Paul speech. You know, I hadn't heard that. And so it's really touching and it's moving to hear him call those names out. But we have to remember Sandra Bland. We have to remember Rekia Boyd and all of the black women who have been killed by police violence or white vigilantes, because too often those names are forgotten. They're not mentioned. They're not lifted up in these conversations.
You know, there's another way. You talked about LeBron James, too, and it's interesting that this is also, they use this platform as a call to action. It's not just us. We're four friends. We play the same sport. But this really is a call to action and a reference, again, back to that time when Muhammad Ali stood for the same kinds of things.
It's time to look in the mirror and ask ourselves, what are we doing to create change? It's not about being a role model. It's not about our responsibility to the tradition of activism. I know tonight we'll honor Muhammad Ali, the GOAT. But to do his legacy any justice, let's use this moment as a call to action for all professional athletes to educate ourselves, explore these issues, speak up, use our influence, and renounce all violence.
Cleveland Cavaliers player LeBron James speaking at last week's ESPY Awards. Is this different in kind? He said, look, this is not just about being a role model. This is not just reaching back to a time when activism was, you know, required of us or expected of us. This is a new kind of activism.
I mean, think about where black athletes have been historically. Right? I mean, you go back 40 years ago, black athletes are going to historically black colleges and universities. They're staying for 4 years. They're being fed intellectually as they're actually, you know, as their talents are also being exploited. You know, we're now in an environment where, you know, cats are one and done. And that 1 year, you know, they might not actually be there sitting right, in the classroom paying attention. So that when LeBron makes this particular claim that given our visibility and our fame and our wealth, that we actually now actually have a responsibility to actually learn something, right, to get to know issues so that we can be active and activist, right? We can be agents of change because we have knowledge of what's happening.
Right.
I think there have been times when he's got caught off guard. I mean, when he was asked to comment, for instance, about the Tamir Rice case, you know, 2 years ago, you know, he didn't quite have a response for it and very readily said, you know, I don't know enough. And I think he took that as kind of a challenge for them, you know, broadly, right, to educate themselves about the facts, about laws, about everything that's going on politically so that when they're put in this position to respond, you know, they can, right? I mean, this is the reason why Charles Barkley is Charles Barkley, right? We might disagree with Charles Barkley about a lot of stuff. And you know, my own thing is that you're going to ask Charles Barkley, when are you asking Larry Bird about about Black Lives Matter and Donald Trump? But that being said, you know, what we do get a sense of is that Charles Barkley reads, right, that he actually knows things, right? He has information. He just has very different opinions. If you have a generation of Black athletes who now come up to speed in that regard, maybe we're not asking Charles Barkley, you know,
Well, that's we're talking today about celebrity status. The other thing that hasn't come up, or maybe I just haven't seen it, is the old claim that, you know, celebrities and athletes should just stick with their knitting and not get involved in this stuff. It seems that the trauma of the street violence lately is at a point where all of America is saying, look, there is no business as usual. So I haven't heard, at least, the claim that we shouldn't be hearing from athletes and stars about these kinds of things.
I mean, I think that there are... definitely, you know, there are people who feel that athletes and celebrities should stay in their lane because there is this perception that they don't know enough, they are not informed enough to make informed opinions and comments about what's going on. But I don't think that any of us can afford to sit back and be silent just because we don't feel like we know enough, because it's clear what's going on, at least to my mind. And if you have any understanding of the direness of this moment, right, then I think we all have a responsibility to speak out and call out what we're seeing.
And they're not immune to any of this stuff. I mean, we talk about a player like Theo Cephalosha, who played for Atlanta Hawks, used to play for Oklahoma City. I mean, he got his leg broken by the NYPD last year, right? So these athletes themselves are targets in very different kinds of ways.
Yeah. Back Channel continues on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. My guests are culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. They're with me for this installment of Back Channel, Connecting Culture and Context. Today we're talking about celebrity activism in response to recent street violence in America. We're talking about the impact of certainly television, kind of a mainstream media, but social media is also a protest tool. Is there a shift? What's the balance these days? Mark, I'll start with you, sort of in how these movements are being propelled on social media versus what we would call mainstream or traditional media.
I think we're seeing more so than the early moments of what we thought of as Black Twitter activism. Really a nice little mix of activism and information being shared on social media. Some information, but also organizing very much on the ground, right? That one of the standard strategies we've seen in recent, you know, in the last year or so are the stopping of major highways and freeways. Right. And much of that is coordinated outside of the use of social media other than to bring attention to it once those things occur. I think the activists have been very clear about the idea of disruption, that you disrupt the status quo, you disrupt the everydayness, the casualness of American life, you know, as a way to respond to the casualness of Black death, you know, in this particular moment.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that is a little perilous, though, about activism right now is that there is such a distrust, there's such a heightened level of tension and conflict that, you know, people feel. And so you almost take your life into your hands to be active, to shut down a highway, because you don't know what will happen. Right. You don't know how police will respond. You don't even know how people who want to get past you in their cars are going to respond. I think that is both. We're at a crossroads, so I think there's a lot of potential, you know, for a seismic shift, actually, in how we move forward. But for right now, it's very disconcerting and troubling.
Well, it's interesting to think about the power of social media, again, to organize people and to get the idea out all at once, particularly if you're disrupting a system. if you look at brutality as the fruit of a system that in its most banal ways, in its everyday shopping activities, mm-hmm. right, and grass-growing activity, promotes the disadvantaging of people of color in order to maintain privilege. If that's your premise, then disrupt the system. You know, in other words, commercial disruption is something that's A, not illegal, and B, kind of easy to organize. Right. I'm interested to see if this becomes the next level, because it really seriously hurts the system, as yes. George Bush made so clear in the aftermath of our greatest trauma. He said, get out there, travel, and shop. Right? In 2001, shopping, because he was right. hearing from his friends on Wall Street that this is killing us, George. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so that was his first message to us. So it'd be fascinating to see if that's kind of the next level of this. What about also, I guess, the revolution will not be televised, but it certainly is showing up on your smartphone.
Yeah.
We're seeing actual video of some of this. What's the impact of that, do you think?
I think it's great in terms of information. I think there are a couple of things at play with this kind of revolution of handheld technology. On the one hand, I think for many black folks and black activists, generally speaking, the technology is actually a culmination of the conversation, right? It's saying to white America, this is what it is, right? Because the conversation is not brand new because of the technology. You know, black folks have right. been dealing with anti-black state violence for centuries, literally. And so it's not as if, you know, folks are coming into knowledge of that. And now suddenly there's technology to say, you know, you thought that we were making some of this up, or there was some mistake, you know, mistaken identity, all this other kind of stuff. It's like, no, here is the actual right. visuals, right?
Right?
Actual data of these things happening. And so I think that's important, but it also creates this moment where I think we're over-traumatized.
Yeah. Mm.
There's just
Absolutely.
So much of it that on the one hand, you get desensitized to all of the violence, but at the same time, it's just too much. I mean, for anyone still trying to wrap their head around Alton Sterling, and then suddenly you're seeing on your Twitter news feed about Philando, and it's like, wait a minute. It's like, really?
Right.
And you're wondering, how could the cops in St. Paul not be cognizant enough of yeah. what was happening in Baton Rouge that they would even be a little bit more cautious, right, in these kind of interactions?
Right. You know, and I think that one really good example of the use of technology is what Philando Castile's girlfriend, Diamond Reynolds, did in the midst of being pulled over after Philando was shot. And that was to broadcast basically what was happening. And I think that that's important for two reasons. First of all, it shows just her presence of mind, that she understood the power of social media and the need to get the truth out. So you can't dispute what you're seeing in real time, right? And then it also helps to change the narrative, because so many times, you know, just about every case where someone black has been shot by police, the whole narrative right. is shifted away from the criminality of the shooting and is pointed at the black person, and they're made to be the criminal,
well, there's
the monster.
Only one source of the narrative, and it comes from the police report.
Right. And so to have this sort of almost like a running diary of what's taking place, you know, a journal of what's taking place as it happens, which can not only be used to help in defense of Philando, you know, posthumously, but also to say, this is what our experience is. Like, this is what's happening. This is the truth of the matter. And I think that's really important.
I wonder if the intersection of, we're talking about celebrity status and using that in activism and also social media, and the intersection might be a recent video, 23 Ways to Be Killed If You're Black in America. Mark, tell us a little bit about that video and how that brings these two together.
It's pretty amazing. I mean, you know, being able to get so many prominent folks, you know, from Beyonce to Kevin Hart, to just talk about individual murders of black folks and the way that they got killed as being emblematic of, you know, a widespread range of black folks being killed in this country. And it was something that was also pulled together by Alicia Keys, who's also on this big no makeup thing. So all of these folks are unadorned, right? You know, folks that mm-hmm. if they weren't wearing their makeup, they might very well be targets themselves, right? In the way that you see them depicted in this video. And it's extraordinarily moving, right? You realize that there has been some sort of shift that has occurred in the last year or two where folks are just getting off the fence now, right? The fact that Beyonce's in that video is significant. You know, John Caramonica did a piece in the Times on Beyonce and Jay-Z's new activism. And, you know, he said it's about Jay-Z in particular. You know, the most interesting stuff that he says these days has everything to do with how being a parent has shifted his way of seeing the world, right? And whatever activism you see the both of them engaged in is a byproduct of, again, wrapping their head around that. Mm-hmm.
We've got a clip from 23 Ways to Be Killed If You're Black in America.
Failing to signal a lane change. Riding in your girlfriend's car with a child in the back.
Running to the bathroom in your own apartment.
Selling cigarettes outside of a corner store.
Riding a commuter train.
Walking home with a friend.
Making eye contact.
Selling CDs outside of a supermarket.
Was a clip from the social media video, 23 Ways to Be Killed If You're Black in America. My guests are pop culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal today on Back Channel. This does seem fundamentally different than the way celebrities had become active before. This is not about talking about the system, but as you say, personalizing this and trying to create an identity so that if this is not your experience, you can somehow identify with this. Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, I'm thinking about Harry Belafonte and those of his generation who, you know, were very outspoken about civil rights and all that was going on in the 60s. And their participation was, I would say, profound. I mean, they were very rooted in what was going on. I think that what we see in celebrity engagement in these issues today, it's certainly not on that level. But I think it goes back to what I was trying to say about you can't afford to be silent. You don't have to be as eloquent and verbose as Harry Belafonte. You don't have to have that type of a presence to make a difference. These people have, and when I say these people, I'm talking about Beyonce and Alicia Keys and all the people that participated in this 23 Ways video, they have a platform. They have an audience. And they can, you know, reach millions of people in ways that Mark and I, and even you, Frank, we never would be able to reach those people. So I think it's very important that they've decided to use their voices in this way.
I want to talk about a speech made by actor Jesse Williams last month at the BET Awards. This is before the recent shootings. Williams received a BET Humanitarian Award. And let's just listen to this clip.
We've been floating this country on credit for centuries, yo. And we're done watching and waiting while this invention called whiteness uses and abuses us, burying black people out of sight and out of mind while extracting our culture, our dollars, our entertainment like oil, black gold, ghettoizing and demeaning our creations, then stealing them, gentrifying our genius, and then trying us on like costumes before discarding our bodies like rinds of strange fruit.
Jesse Williams, a speech at the BET Awards last month. Natalie Bullock Brown, Mark Anthony Neal are with me here today. Maybe you should tell us, Mark, you know, give us an idea who Jesse Williams is and why that speech might have been important. Natalie?
Well, Jesse Williams is, I came to know him at least, as one of the very fine doctors on Shonda Rhimes' Grey's Anatomy.
Yeah, we heard the way you said fine.
You know, but that's how I knew of him. But he is the son of activist parents. And I think, you know, part of what is so amazing about his BET speech is that, you know, up to that point, I don't think people really realize the extent to which he has been engaged in activism and all the things that he has been doing. So to see BET's presentation about, you know, why they were giving him the Humanitarian Award, and then to hear him, like, really basically pull it all together in a way that I've never heard anybody speak like that on BET or really anywhere else, was just phenomenal. And, you know, he's an actor, but he has definitely decided to use his platform.
And to your point, Natalie, he did raise the issue of women.
Now, this is also in particular for the black women in particular who have spent their lifetimes dedicated to nurturing everyone before themselves. we can and will do better for you.
Yeah, and that's important.
Yeah.
That's important.
Is this, but this raises the question, too, whether or not, and particularly with social media, I mean, this is BET, so we're talking about television, but we had earlier talked about social media, whether or not this call to action is, if this is to rally consciousness in communities of color or a kind of consciousness in white communities, a sense of, you know, waking up to what's going on. I mean, how effective is this in reaching out to cultures and communities that don't feel this?
I think it's a both and. I must say, you know, when we talk about Jesse Williams, also a black studies major at Temple University. So what can you do with a black studies degree?
There you go.
You can be Jesse Williams. But I think it does a little of both. I think the speech was important at the BET Awards. But, you know, I can think about some of the old heads that I talked to afterwards, right, who might not have heard anything extraordinary in the content of the speech, but it was where the speech was occurring that was significant,
yeah.
Right? So this is an attempt to reach to a very distinct black millennial audience that's really all caught up in their Instagram followers and things like that. And yeah, they have a sense of what's happening politically. They don't necessarily know how to engage that, right? So he speaks to that audience, right? I also think, because it seemed unscripted, absolutely unscripted. And I think after he sat there and listened to Harry Belafonte talk about him.
Right.
You know, he had to kind of up the ante, right? Mm-hmm. And I think what's even more important than him, because, you know, to the extent that there's any risk to his career, you know, he's on a show that's produced by a black woman, Shonda Rhimes, who had his back immediately,
right?
And as long as that show delivers ratings, you know, he'll be fine. And to that extent, it crosses over to this white audience. But when he gets up there, you know, he's representing Belafonte, right? He's representing somebody like Hazel Scott, you know, the pianist who was married to Adam Clayton Powell, right, who deserves a story as much as Nina Simone deserves,
right?
A whole generation of these black celebrities who've always went out on the limb to speak truth to power. I mean, hell, we could talk about folks like Stephen Fetchett, you know, who while he was, you know, shuffling and jiving on screen and as Lincoln Perry, the actor, right, he's writing checks to the NAACP and anti-lynching, you know, movements and what have you. So there's a long history of that he animated at that moment. And again, if you're LeBron and Chris Paul and Beyonce, if any of these folks, it's like, and this is literally how some of the narrative was, the light-skinned dude is like embarrassing us.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Well, we've been talking about celebrities who have been outspoken in their activism. And now I want to switch gears and talk about a celebrity who was perhaps one of the most famous athletes and celebrities in America and who famously or infamously walked away from his any sense of responsibility about that. And that's O.J. Simpson, who has come to our attention with two TV series, one a dramatic series and then also a documentary series on ESPN. To just generally talk about the renewed interest in O.J.
I think in terms of 20th century American culture, nothing is right there at the centerpiece of race in America than the O.J. Simpson trial. I think all the conversations that we've been having post Baton Rouge, post St. Paul, post Dallas, is understandable in the context of just looking at how America dealt with O.J. Simpson, right? The inability to believe that black folks would believe that he might have been set up. Or even if they didn't believe that he was set up, if they actually believed he did it, they're looking at a 200-year history of cases where white folks got off for killing blacks. I mean, that's a whole deep kind of history, right? When Obama talks about, you know, I don't think the country is as divided as he thinks it is, he actually probably needs to watch, you know, O.J. Made in America to understand the roots of this particular contemporary moment around these conversations.
Right.
Yeah, well, let's listen to producer. Now, we're talking about the ESPN documentary series that was produced by Ezra Edelman, and he talks about how he thinks O.J. fits into the American cultural picture.
He had an ambition to be famous from the time he was young. He didn't have an ambition to be the greatest football player ever. He didn't have an ambition to be rich. He had an ambition to be famous. Now, what that means in some ways is O.J. also had an ambition to be loved and loved by everybody. And I think it informs this story in a very powerful way because it speaks to how all of us were seduced by him. And the image that we saw on the screen, both, frankly, as a football player, and not just because he was wildly successful, but that he was so graceful on the football field, so beautiful, in a way that when we're watching as a viewer, as a fan, he brought us pleasure. He brought in, so we're connected to this guy, even though he's just an image on the screen.
There we go. That's a clip of director and producer Ezra Edelman talking with the online publication Big Think last month. And my guests are pop culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Yeah, how does he fit into the picture? I mean, he is a fascinating kind of one of these liminal characters who either transcends or doesn't the kind of the racial story in America.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's if you watch the series, one of the things that becomes very clear is that number one, what Ezra Edelman says is that he wanted to be famous, but OJ seemed to want to be famous to the detriment of his relationship with the black community. And so if it was convenient for him to sort of shun the community in service of his pursuit of this fame, but certainly when he needed us, he came running back. And so that's very problematic, clearly. But I think it speaks to, sort of the... there's a phrase that I'm trying to grab, but I think a lot of black people have that sort of, that tenuous relationship, being on the fence when you have a certain status and you've got to sort of nurture that status, but it doesn't really, it's not really expedient for you to have the sort of relationship you might want to have with your community.
And the series and the documentary explores the way in which that is actually a choice, in which you have to choose being black or being a celebrity and renouncing that in order to be successful. And that's fat. We'll talk more about that as our conversation with Mark Anthony Neal and Natalie Bullock Brown continues on Back Channel. Stay with us on The State of Things. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking with Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal on this edition of Back Channel. Culture and context in connection. And today we're talking about the recent ESPN documentary series OJ Made in America. And we talked about sort of OJ's refusal to take on his blackness and to be an activist. And there's a clip from the documentary that I think talks about that very idea.
The whole idea behind the Olympic Project for Human Rights was to escalate the relationship between elite athletes and the civil rights movement. OJ was approached because he was the biggest name in collegiate athletics at that time. He was also a world record holding track star.
That's OJ Simpson.
So here we got two for one. When I asked him, I said, we're trying to get black athletes to understand they have a role in the current civil rights movement. His response was, I'm not black, I'm OJ.
What they think is right, I guess they must follow their beliefs. Well, right now I don't want to be involved in it because I'm not in track. I'm running track, but when it comes to Olympic time, I'll be in football, so I have no comment on the matter.
Clip from sociologist Harry Edwards from the ESPN documentary series OJ Made in America. I'm talking with Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Mark, the idea that... And again, here's OJ trying to do this thing. This is a post-racial America already, and we don't have to talk about that anymore. I've made it, and I think America's ready to come along with me.
It's impossible to remember who young OJ was without thinking about him as the antidote to Jim Brown.
Hmm.
Another collegiate football player, pro player, the most visible black football player in that generation. Running partner with Ali and Malcolm X and all those kinds of folks, very outspoken. And clearly, the systems, if you will, were looking for a figure that they could hang their hat on that was not going to be difficult like Jim Brown. And OJ was very comfortable falling into that role, right? And again, this is a moment where, let's not think that OJ is totally out of pocket for a moment, right? This is a moment where there's a significant amount of black folks in this country that believe that the ability of black folks to integrate into very visible spaces. This is Diane Carroll and Julia on TV. This is Sidney Poitier in film, though when you see In the Heat of the Night, even he is challenging this idea that his presence is going down easy on white America. OJ clearly begins to think that if he can be successful as a football player, you know, that if he crosses over as his black artist, that this, as his black athlete, that this is a good thing for black America. So he, you know, he's not working independently there. There are a lot of black folks who believe this at this point in time.
Right. But, you know, it's interesting because, you know, thinking about the moment that we're in right now in America, and the fact that it is so clear that, you know, your stature as a black person really doesn't have that much to do with how you are perceived, and that you can still find yourself, you know, with a gun pointed at you. I think, you know, this sort of aspirational denial that many black people have had to contend with, just trying to and really kind of make peace with the fact that that doesn't do anything for you. It's not going to save you. It's not going to protect you. It's not going to really, at the end of the day, take you where you want to go.
No, but as Mark points out, this is a point in American history where everybody wants to believe that
right.
That look, all we need is just for a few people to make it, and then once that happens, we will be in this.
Get Bill Cosby on a television show.
Cosby is there, and we've reached this kind of post-racial utopia. So you, again, I think bringing us back to that moment is important, but there's also something else going on, because where Muhammad Ali and Jim Brown were athletes and you couldn't deny their power and skill as athletes and therefore the attention they got, you couldn't control what they were going to say. Here's a guy who wants to kind of behave, right? He wants to
absolutely
get past this. But there's still some sculpting going on, right? There's still some engineering. So we get now to the O.J. Simpson Hertz commercial, right? And the film, the documentary, takes a look at this and shows how his popularity outside of football, as well as how white society was able to manipulate his image in that famous Hertz commercial.
OJ was the first to demonstrate that white folks would buy stuff based on a black endorsement, as long as it was not pressed as a black endorsement. And the way they did that was to remove black people totally from any scene that OJ was in.
Miss Harry Edwards from the ESPN documentary series O.J. Made in America. And I don't know, you may not have seen that commercial, but it's O.J. running through. So it's a black man running, first of all, and he doesn't
right
get shot. So that is significant in and of itself. But he's running through an airport. Not only are there no black people, but as Harry Edwards points out, I think there are white people, only white people, and they're cheering him on. Let's listen.
Go, Jules! Go!
Rent a Ford from Hertz, a superstar in Rent-A-Car. Right.
They bought the notion that you could erase the black character, the culture. This is what made O.J. marketable.
He's African, but he's a good-looking man. You know, he almost has white features. He wasn't the typical black look, African look.
Shades of Joe Biden, right? I mean, but I mean, that's sort of. But this is that moment, right? This is a deliberate effort now. This is not just OJ walking away. This is advertisers saying, "Oh, we can make this work for us."
As you just said, Frank. Then, as now, black male running through the airport like that is getting stopped, shot, beaten, a whole range of things, right? And when you hear the director say, we had to make sure that there was some sort of feature in those commercials where whiteness co-signed his presence, right? Because everybody would be looking at it going like, who's this black guy running through the airport? But the thing that's telling to me, at the time that OJ is doing these Hertz commercials, Muhammad Ali, who's at the apex of his visibility and unquestionably might be the most well-known athlete of the 20th century, let alone black athlete, you know, he's selling roach spray for Decon. And that's real telling, right?
Yeah.
You know, that, you know, that so it's not even about popularity, right, in this regard, right? Recognition, it's about a certain kind of recognition and a certain kind of politics, you know, that's allowed to kind of feed through. I always said that, you know, O.J. Simpson to me is the one guy, black person who transcended race, not in the sense that, you know, he didn't look black or anything like that, but you would think about ways to describe OJ before you would go, oh yeah,
and
he's
black.
A black guy.
Yeah.
So and this is also, I think this coincides, I think, with the war on drugs. We're talking about race relations. Let's go back a little bit, because the series that we're talking about, looks at the relationship with Nicole Brown and allegations of domestic abuse. And so, again, how these other narratives of crime sort of fit into the OJ picture. Let's listen to a clip of former LAPD police officer Ron Shipp from the documentary.
I got a call from downstairs. Someone wants to talk to you. And there's Nicole in the lobby. Hey, Nicole, what's up? You know, she goes, did you hear about what happened? I said, yeah, I did hear what happened. And she told me it wasn't the first time. Showed me the pictures from the past, beatings, and I looked at those pictures, and my heart just like dropped. I was like, man, this guy is a typical batter.
That's a clip of LAPD officer Ron Shipp from the ESPN series OJ Made in America, talking with Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. So again, this is sort of part of the narrative now that's going to play out as that trial unfolds. And Natalie, you've talked too about Nicole Brown and sort of her role in this and how that has been. We haven't really told that story in a way. This is also part of, you know, part of the OJ story.
Yeah, I think that you know, one of the things that I thought about as I was watching the series was how much of the story of the domestic abuse and the abuser relationship with OJ's abusive relationship with Nicole, you know, what didn't really get dealt with, and it seems to me that if you're really going to do the domestic violence justice, you have someone, you have an expert who can talk about domestic abuse in the film, helping to contextualize, you know, what was going on. And really the only person that is sort of the expert is Ron Shipp, because he had a background in dealing with domestic violence survivors. But I do think that, you know, I feel like there's a whole other film that could be done about the OJ case that deals specifically with the treatment of Nicole, the treatment of OJ's first wife, and like that dynamic, you know, what does it feel like to be a black woman whose black husband leaves you for a white woman? The ways in which Nicole is very much so, and I have to give credit to one of my Facebook friends, Tamara Lomax, who in her analysis of the series made this really poignant point about the fact that Nicole's body is covered up in a way that black bodies are never covered up. Mm-hmm. They're never afforded that level of protection. So I just, there's a lot that I think as wonderful and as amazing as this documentary series is, and as important as it is, there's still so much more that could be looked into.
Well, I think that speaks to the complexity of the story and how many currents, both in racial and gender dynamics, run through his story.
I think the thing that lives with me in watching its series is just how emphatically it makes clear, whether it was intentional or not, that the system fundamentally failed Nicole Simpson.
Absolutely.
On so many different levels, at so many different points. O.J. Simpson should have been in jail and not have been around to been able to murder her, you know, in that kind of context. I mean, it's pretty amazing. And again, it speaks to how we thought about gender at that period of time.
Yes.
You know, where so much of this domestic intimate partner abuse is just seen as what a marriage is or what a relationship is. It's just a fight. I think if that occurs in the contemporary moment, particularly around social media, all of that plays out very differently.
Right? Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to say also that I think that the fact that, okay, I lost it. You can go ahead.
Well, the question I was going to ask is how this might have played out differently if it hadn't been OJ. In other words, if he hadn't played the role that white America wanted him to play,
there you go.
Would he have been jailed long before this just on abuse charges? Mm-hmm. If he had been LeBron, if he had been Jim Brown, who, you know, was convicted, I think, at least certainly accused of abuse, what would have happened if he had not been the guy who was so compliant and played that role?
Right. And that's what I was trying to say, or was coming to mind, is that I think that, you know, it's pretty clear from the documentary, at least, that a part of the reason why OJ, you know, was able to avoid being arrested even 8 times, from what Nicole says in those audio tapes, is because there was such an investment in believing that this man was and was not so much above the law, but that, you know, the superstar would never, you know, do these things. But on top of that, you know, we are so enamored of this man that we don't want to to arrest him. And you know, that sort of plays out in ways, at least in the storytelling of the series, that's really disturbing, because both white and black police officers are, you know, saying, well, I tried to arrest him, but I couldn't, you know, he got away, or, you know, and nobody else would be allowed the level of escape.
Which level of superstar, again, OJ which was. Superstars, because there are superstars, who African-American superstars, who do get arrested. And so, I mean, we're quite ready to believe that. And I think in this case, because he played this liminal figure, you know, real and otherwise. To what extent, too, I guess we're talking about race relations in California in the 1960s, you know, that this also plays out in the drug wars as well. And this is all, you know, sort of part of this. It works its way into the documentary, this arc from the 1960s when O.J. begins his career and comes out of Southern California, and then, you know, finds himself sort of in the heat of things now in the early 90s.
I think there's no way to watch, you know, O.J. Made in America and not contextualize it around the use of police force to control drug use in black communities and drug sales. You can't watch this without thinking about the rise of a group like NWA as a response to these things. You cannot divorce it from the Rodney King beating, the LaTosha Harling shooting, and the riots, quote-unquote riots, that ensue in 1992 in response, you know, to both of those cases. It's all in there, right? There's no way to deal with O.J. Simpson in that context without dealing with those kind of the realities. That great scene in the documentary where they're finally taking him from the house in handcuffs, and he's looking around, right? Because, you know, black folks, for whatever reason, are closing ranks around him, and he just goes to the police officers, why are all these N-words in my neighborhood? and just you realize emphatically, right, he's not closing ranks with these folks, right? He's never seen himself that way. But again, because of this longer history about, you know, race and policing and the failure to do the right thing around justice, you know, a fair amount of black folks, you know, were supportive of O.J. And Johnny Cochran in particular could exploit that history, even in L.A. with Mark Furman. One of the most problematic things about the documentary for me was that Mark Furman was given a platform of privilege, right, to comment on what happened in this series. And it's like, okay, yeah, O.J., I believe O.J. is a murderer, but at the same time, I still also believe you're a racist.
Right.
You know, nothing about this has debunked that fact. And why are you given this kind of higher platform as a racist to be able to comment on this case?
Well, as always, we are out of time, and we have so much more to talk about, and I wish we had more time to do that, but I want to thank my guests on this month's edition of Back Channel, Mark Anthony Neal, Natalie Bullock Brown. Mark, a professor of African and African-American studies at Duke University. He is an author and the host of the webcast Left of Black. Mark, as always, a pleasure. Thank you so much. And Natalie Bullock Brown is a professor of film and broadcast media at St. Augustine's University in Raleigh and is an Emmy-nominated film producer herself. Thanks, Natalie.
Thank you, Frank.
You can find out more information about all the things we talked about at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Will Michaels, and Charlie Shelton Ormond. Robin Copley is our technical director, Brent Wolf, WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.